is a great way to get a great deal and support a vital community network. The series takes place most Fridays and Saturdays over the summer from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 100 Crimea Street in Guelph. This is a physically accessible location. For the full schedule, check out guelphfoodbank.ca under Volunteers and Support.
Hi, I'm Doug Blackwood. I've been hosting Seems Like Old Times for about 25 years now, featuring music and old radio 1930s to 50s. The show also focuses on issues and history-oriented subjects for older adults. If you know of something that would make a good topic of discussion, or would like to hear a piece of music or old radio show repeated, why not email me at seemslikeoldtimes@cfru.ca. Seems Like Old Times, Wednesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Imagine something different.
The politics of austerity are driving environmental destruction and deepening inequality on a planetary scale, and mass movements have formed all over the globe to resist it. From Quebec to Greece to Chile to South Africa, millions are rising up against austerity. Let's join them.
On Saturday, June 13th, activists, organizers, and community members from throughout southwestern Ontario will meet for the regional summit to unite against austerity at 95 Crimea Street in Guelph, just across from the food bank. The event runs from 3 to 9 p.m. and will feature workshops, educationals, trainings, and a panel discussion.
Attendance is free, food and childcare will be provided, and the event is wheelchair accessible. For more information on the summit and the effects of austerity generally, go to uniteagainstausterity.ca or contact ontarioagainstausterity@gmail.com.
This indigenous isle, from pillaging fat cats, sitting on money piles, doing dirty deeds of the first percent.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Thank you.
listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that, of course, was the Soviet national anthem as it was played on the 60th anniversary of the 1917 October Socialist Revolution in 1977 in Red Square. You know, and that is the reason why I play that, the reason why I introduce the show with that, is just to emphasize, you know, a point which I've made many, many times on this show, is just how pivotal 1917 was in shaping the world over the past century. You cannot understand the world today without understanding 1917 or what happened in the development of the workers' struggle, not just in Russia, but around the world. And for that matter, the struggle for the rights of women, the struggle for national self-determination of colonized peoples. You know, and all these struggles that are going on, that are ongoing in the world today, you know, as people rise up and fight back against imperialism, against capitalism. 1917, even if it didn't initiate these struggles itself, took them to a new level and redefined what was possible, you know, for millions upon millions upon millions of people all around the world. Colonized people, working people, you know, racialized people, what have you. And this is something that doesn't get talked about, and it really needs to be talked about, you know, like in society today, because this is absolutely crucial to understand. You know, if we want to build a better world right now, you know, we have to understand what needs to be done, you know, to see that world constructed. And we can only understand that if we understand what happened in history, in the modern era. This is absolutely crucial to understand. Now, some of you might remember, 2 weeks ago I started talking about a man named Al Szymanski, who wrote a book in the early 1980s, came out, I believe, in 1981, called Human Rights in the Soviet Union. Now, this book, which he draws upon almost exclusively from non-Soviet sources, attempts to give an overview about where the Soviet Union, which still, of course, existed at the time, stood with regards to human rights. You know, whether that's the right of various nations for self-determination, national minorities, whether that's the rights of women, whether that's the rights of working people, and so on. How does it stand in terms of human rights? And his findings were very, very positive, just overall. Like, it's absolutely amazing reading this book, and I have not actually finished the book. But just the parts of it which I've gone over, and remember last time I talked about it, I went over how the Soviet Union worked to empower national minorities who had been oppressed under the Tsarist Empire before 1917, and how it worked to, in, you know, basically to secure for those nations national self-determination, where they could develop themselves on their own terms, you know, and put priority on the economic development of those areas that had, you know, those exploited regions of the country, those colonized areas, historically colonized and oppressed areas of the Soviet, of the former Russian Empire. You know, the priority it placed on that, and just how basically you cannot call the Soviet Union empire on that basis. Well, today what I really want to do is I have with me my friend Brendan Campisi, friend and comrade.
Hi.
Who has been on the show previously. We had a very good discussion the last time he was on about the African-American struggle for liberation and particularly the Black Panther Party, and just how that struggle developed over time. And it was very, very, very good. So I'm very happy to have him back on. And we're going to talk about Szymanski's book, and particularly kind of expand on where I talked about him before, and talk about the struggles that the rights that women won in the Soviet Union, and also the rights of working people in the Soviet Union. We're going to focus on that today. So welcome, Brendan.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to have you back. So what are we going to start with? We're just going to kind of start to get things rolling. First of all, maybe you could kind of sketch out just a little bit what were conditions for women in the Soviet Union? And then I guess I'll you know, we can kind of go beyond that about like where they were before 1917.
Right. So before we get started, or before I get into talking about what Szymanski had to say about women in the Soviet Union, I would just like to point listeners to another source of information about this issue that I found useful, and I think other, you know, listeners would find useful. So at least for people who are in Canada anyway.
Okay.
I think last year, one of the leaders of the Communist Party of Canada, the leader of the Communist Party in Ontario, Liz mm-hmm. Rowley, gave an interview where she talked about the situation of women in the Soviet Union mm-hmm. and in the most recent issue of Rebel Youth, which is the Young Communist League of Canada's publication, which was focused on women's issues. We published that interview, and there's a lot of really, really interesting information. Liz went to the Soviet Union, I believe, in the 1970s or 80s, and so she had some firsthand experience with that. But it's also very interesting as a source of historical information about that. So I'll partially be drawing on that as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, as you mentioned, Szymanski talks about human rights in the Soviet Union in a number of areas in this book, and sort of the three areas that he goes into detail on are the situation of oppressed nationalities or formerly oppressed nationalities, the situation of women, and the situation of workers. And the chapter in Human Rights in the Soviet Union on women is interesting because it's probably the of those three sections, and there is more to the book, there are other areas that are covered, but maybe we'll get to that at some point in the future. Of those three sections, it's probably the least kind of unambiguously celebratory. At various points, Szymanski is careful to acknowledge the existence of discrimination against women in the Soviet Union, and the existence of sexist ideas and attitudes in Soviet society. Whereas he argues that, national oppression, as Siegfried discussed a couple weeks ago, had basically been abolished. But I'm not going to focus on the negative side of things first, or I don't want to. So the way Szymanski discusses the situation of the Soviet Union, of women in the Soviet Union, and is primarily through comparison with the West. That's sort of one of the goals in Human Rights in the Soviet Union, is to compare, not just to describe the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. but to compare the Soviet Union to Western advanced capitalist countries, and first and foremost to the United States. There are a couple of areas where there were very, very clearly, enormous achievements made in the situation of women in the Soviet Union. And one of the most important of those was the area of education. And so Szymanski spends a fair bit of time talking about that. And of course, we'll talk a bit about this later, but the situation on that front at the time of the revolution was pretty drastic. Most women in the Russian Empire, majority of women in the Russian Empire were illiterate, and that varied based on regions. And in some areas of the country, particularly in Central Asia, literacy among women was basically non-existent. And then by the late 1930s, literacy among women and girls was universal in the Soviet Union. And the gender gap in literacy had been basically eliminated in every part of the country. So within a generation, that had been achieved. By the 1960s, primary and secondary education was universal for everyone in the Soviet Union, and that included women. I don't want to get too bogged down in the statistics. Szymanski provides a lot of very useful statistics, but I don't want to spend too much time on them. But one that stuck out to me was that between, I believe it was 1939 and 1977, he says that the proportion of women in higher education in the Soviet Union increased by 10 times. And also during that time, the gender gap in higher education also was completely eliminated in the Soviet Union. Another statistic that stands out, and this is related to education and professional advancement, I suppose. In 1980, the Soviet Union there were more women engineers in the Soviet Union than there were in every other country on Earth put together. So that's pretty impressive. And Szymanski discusses how women in the Soviet Union had made significant gains in terms of moving into what are or were in Western capitalist societies, traditionally male-dominated professions in law, in economics, sort of that kind of area. And I found this interesting because, you know, there are obviously for a lot of people on the left, we'll say that that's nothing terribly impressive, and that we need to be concerned, you know, first and foremost with the situation of working class women and, you know, oppressed nationality women, etc., rather than looking at, you know, whether whether women are moving into these positions of relative privilege in society. And that's not illegitimate. And the other thing is that I don't know the statistic for this off the top of my head, but I would tend to believe that by now the advanced capitalist Western countries are at the level of of the representation of women in these professions that the Soviet Union was at in the 1980s. It is important, and it's definitely worth noting and worth talking about that in the 1970s and 80s, when mm-hmm. Szymanski's statistics are from, that the advanced capitalist countries in the West were behind the Soviet Union on this. So just a couple sort of things sort of stuck out to me when sort of looking at that as a metric. But another enormously important aspect of the situation of women in the Soviet Union, and one of the great achievements of Soviet society in this regard, was the fact that, again, in sharp contrast to Western capitalist society, childcare in the Soviet Union was completely free and available to everyone. Most people had childcare, I believe, through their employer, through the enterprise that they worked for. Industrial enterprises that had 500 employees or more all had to have childcare on the premises.
Mm-hmm.
And then for most people, whether or not it was actually available in their workplace, childcare was paid for, again, I believe for the most part, by their employers. And again, you know, this is a huge contrast to Western capitalist society,
where
childcare is an enormous cost and a huge source of stress for families. But still, you know, for the most part, for women, this is seen as, you know, obviously this is an area that women for the most part have to take care of, a burden that they have to shoulder. Speaking of burdens that women have to shoulder, Szymanski also talks about the issue of domestic labor in the Soviet Union. And the picture that he paints is that domestic labor in the Soviet Union was remarkably egalitarian by the 1970s and 80s. Perhaps not exactly equal, but broadly speaking, domestic labor was shared out mm-hmm. fairly equally between men and women, which in contrast to Western society then and Western society now. Where, you know, at all, in most Western countries, domestic labor is still overwhelmingly, you know, it, obviously it varies and it, you know, depends on class situation and all these other factors. But we can still say that the trend is that domestic labor is something that is imposed on women.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that women in the Soviet Union spent less time doing domestic labor, despite the fact that domestic labor was much less mechanized in the Soviet Union than it was in Western capitalist societies. You know, not every, you know, how there, you know, it wasn't nearly as common in the Soviet Union in 1980 for households to have, you know, a washing machine than in the West. But obviously what this shows is that the availability of certain kinds of technology is not the crucial factor in deciding this. It's looking at the society and the relations between, you know, the social relations and, you know, the relations in the social relations within the family and as those are affected and the household and as those are affected by the wider society. And of course, mm-hmm. with this extensive public childcare, a significant portion of what is in a capitalist society domestic labor was not really domestic in the first place. It was an area of social labor. So those are probably the some of the important things that Szymanski sort of signposts as far as the situation of women in what we could call late Soviet society.
Right. Yeah. Because, like, one of the just contrasting that with what came before 1917, before the revolution, and of course, like, the revolution itself, I mean, women played a pretty major role. I mean, you can see Alexander Kollontai and, you know, mobilizing women to take part in the strikes, which actually began on International Women's Day in February 1917, playing a very pivotal role in bringing down the Tsar. This is before the Bolshevik Revolution even happened.
Yeah.
And the role that women played in the 1905 revolution in terms of them going out on the streets and standing alongside the men in resisting the in resisting the Tsar's forces, who were using the utmost force to try to crush the what was really the most successful general strike in human history. You know, I still think it holds the record for actually paralyzing an entire country on that scale, seeing that Russia was and still is the largest country in the world. And just the scale of the workers' action in that year, back in 1905. But even before then, I mean, a lot of people know Alexandra Kollontai and Nadezhda Krupskaya, Lenin's wife, and the role that they played in the revolutionary struggle. But even before then, you had people like Vera Figner and like other revolutionaries who were engaged in the struggle against the Tsars and even, you know, collaborated in the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in around, like, I believe it was 1971. And just there were always women in the revolutionary struggle, you know, in Russia. In some cases, they were even more militant than the men. Because, of course, one of the things you have to realize in society, basically before 1917, Russia, like, to say nothing of the you could say colonized societies within the Tsarist Empire, was deeply patriarchal, deeply beholden to religious control by the Russian Orthodox Church in particular, which, of course, was part of the state apparatus. And it basically tried to govern the morals of the Russian people. And, of course, you know, you see this in the poor agrarian societies around the world, like how patriarchy is very much cemented, you know, by tradition, by hardship, you know, and the fact that in a lot of places, of course, like the man, you know, tries to, you know, who is probably in desperate straits himself, the only thing that he can control is the family. You know, and just living in that kind of poverty really cements that kind of control, that kind of relationship. You know, not to mention, of course, the kind of attitudes like that wider society kind of propagates and those kind of situations. So, like, it was a very, very negative situation that women were in, very disempowering situation. That they essentially had virtually no rights in the Tsarist Empire. So, basically seeing that, like, seeing that women were in many cases a much worse off state in Russia and certainly in the colonized areas of the Tsarist Empire compared to Western countries, you know, you see how far that women in the Soviet Union came. Mm-hmm. You know, and especially almost right after 1917, they gained, you know, a huge amount of formal rights. I mean, it took a while for a lot of those rights maybe to be realized, you know, as the country became, you know, developed and, you know, economically progressed and went through all kinds of stages of development after 1917. But, you know, the progress was immense, you know, and one of the first countries that where it actually even happened, where we were even able to gain formal rights, like formal equality, you know, let alone substantive equality. You know, so I think that's something that people need to really keep in mind, you know, when we're talking about women's rights in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I didn't mention this. This is another thing that Liz Rowley talks about in this interview that I mentioned earlier, is that in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, 1917, 1918, women in Russia gained full formal equality. And in many cases, women in the early Soviet Union had formal rights that women in Western capitalist countries wouldn't have until the 1970s. And again, this is even just at the level of whether these rights are in law. One thing that I forgot to mention is on the crucial issue of reproductive rights.
Right.
Abortion in the Soviet Union it was legalized very early on after the revolution, and then that was rescinded in the 1930s at a certain point in the context of all kinds of social crisis and a perceived need to keep the birth rate up, and all these, you know, these pressures and factors we can talk about. But I don't know the full timeline here, but eventually it was legalized again. And in the 1960s and 70s, or by that time, abortion in the Soviet Union was legal on demand, and it was available for a tiny fee, except for women with low incomes, for whom it was free. So, and you know, you look at the situation in many Western capitalist countries today, even Canada, where abortion is, you know, it's not illegal, but it's in this sort of odd legal, you know, gray area ever since the 80s, and where in most of the country, it's not, practically speaking, actually available. And then just compare that, you know, to the Soviet Union, where it was, again, universally available. And basically for free, it's that's another enormous achievement.
Yeah, this is true. And of course, that was very shortly after the revolution that started to become available, right? Like, and that's light years ahead of just about everybody else.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, another thing that needs to be mentioned, of course, is the participation of women in the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War, the fight against fascism, where the Soviet Union basically was the only country in that war where women participated in active combat situations. You know, I believe, I mean, I obviously that's somewhat exempting to the Chinese communists, perhaps, you know, where, of course, women were involved in parts of the struggle, certainly in the guerrilla fight against the Japanese invaders, for example. But, I mean, in the Soviet Union, like, they were part of the Red Army, they were part of the partisan movement, they were part of the Red Air Force, they were, you know, like, night bomber squadrons, like, made up entirely of entirely of women, you know, female snipers, like Radmila Pavlichenko, who Woody Guthrie actually wrote a song about.
Right.
You know? And just all these women who actually made massive contributions to the war effort that were beyond, like, say, just working in factories, which, of course, you know, women all across the board, like, whether that's in Britain or in America or wherever, like women stepped into the workforce, many workplace kind of jobs that were originally filled by men during the war. But in the Soviet Union, they actually participated in combat situations, you know, so it was even there you can kind of see the difference, even though this is the 1940s.
Yeah.
You can see the women are in a different place compared to women in the West, you know. So, I mean, all these things are very important to remember, you know, like where when you were talking about human rights in the Soviet Union, and of course, women's rights in particular, right? So I'm just going to take a short music break. I'm going to play a song which originally was by Woody Guthrie, seeing I just mentioned him, and which is sung by Billy Bragg. And so this is called She Came Along to Me.
Attract the most balanced insane, and the wild and the reckless tick up with the clock and the time, and the mixture is of us, and we're still mixing. But never, 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 never could have it been done if the women hadn't entered into the deal, like she came along to me. And all creeds and kinds colors of us are blending, till I suppose 10 million years from now we'll all be just alike.
same size, we're working together, and maybe we'll have all of the fascists out of the way by then.
Maybe so.
But never, 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 never could have it been done if the women hadn't entered into the deal like she came along to me.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was Billy Bragg. She Came Along to Me, originally a Woody Guthrie song. And that was off the album which he did with Wilco called Mermaid Avenue, which has supplied me quite a few interesting musical choices for this show. Let's just say that. You know, I definitely like Woody Guthrie's work. So we're here talking with Brendan Campisi about human rights in the Soviet Union, and particularly about Al Szymanski's treatment of the subject in his book Human Rights in the Soviet Union, which it was 1981, right?
That came out. I believe it was 83.
83.
But, you know.
I knew it was one of those years. I just couldn't remember quite exactly what it was. But, of course, one of the reasons we're talking about this is because this is a subject which is widely misunderstood.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the Soviet Union is, I mean, socialist countries in general, but the Soviet Union in particular, is traditionally viewed largely through the lens of Cold War propaganda as, you know, just a hellhole.
Yep.
When it comes to human rights, you know, a place where basically there was no human rights. You know, this is basically how it's viewed even now by many people in the West, by popular culture,
mm-hmm.
in particularly in North America, but even in parts of in Europe, Western Europe.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that not many people have really challenged in a very meaningful way, but like Szymanski is definitely one of them. And of course, he did this in the 1980s when, you know, it's like the whole Cold War. It was called the New Cold War at that point because, you know, this is when Ronald Reagan is really ratcheting up and, like, escalating the rhetoric, escalating U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Central America and all these areas and imperialist wars, and really, you know, threatening the Soviet Union with nuclear attack, you know, and this, and he's writing this at this particular time. So, like, maybe you could even just mention, like, a few things about the man, seeing I didn't really, who Al Szymanski even was.
Sure.
When, seeing, you know, a few details.
Yeah. So it is important to point to the historical context of this book, Human Rights in the Soviet Union, that was very self-consciously the context in which Szymanski wrote this book was the context of the Second Cold War. And he says very clearly in the introduction, he discusses how, ever since sort of the Carter administration, human rights had become one of the main ideological themes, if not the single most important ideological theme in American propaganda mm-hmm. against
right.
socialism and national liberation in the world. So it is important to point to that. So Al Szymanski was an American sociologist who, like many people, like many thousands of people of his generation, he was born in the 40s, came to communist politics out of the mass movements of the 1960s, out of the student movement, the anti-war movement. For white people like Szymanski, out of supporting the Afro-American liberation movement. And so that was sort of a starting point for Szymanski. And for a long time, he was part of the current of the American New Left that that sympathized very closely with the Cultural Revolution and with China. He was never sort of a hardline Maoist in the sense of joining one of these organizations that took its cues from China on every conceivable point of doctrine and policy. But he was in sort of what historians call the soft Maoist current. They were very sympathetic to China, even if they didn't follow it on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the mid-1970s, that current began to run into some difficulties because it became increasingly obvious that Chinese foreign policy was going in a frightening direction of alliance with the United States. And so people had to sort of start And this manifested itself in, you know, supporting neocolonial forces on the side of apartheid South Africa in Angola and places like this. So in that context, many of these young communists in the U.S. and other Western countries had to start reconsidering aspects of the experience of socialism in China at that time and the ideological framework that they'd taken up from the Chinese. And part of that was the claim that that the Soviet Union was no more progressive than Western society, if indeed it was even if indeed it wasn't worse than Western society. And you had Chinese and Albanian pronouncements that the Soviet Union is a fascist dictatorship of the Hitler type and all this stuff. So in the mid-1970s, people like Al Szymanski start questioning that framework. And in 1978, Szymanski came out with a book called, or 1979, Is the Red Flag Flying? The Political Economy of the Soviet Union Today, in which he argues, you know, very, very compellingly, that the Soviet Union was a socialist country and that the basic character of its politics internally and internationally was progressive and profoundly so. So at that point, he became basically the most influential, or one of the most influential defenders of the Soviet Union on the section of the far left in the United States that had sort of previously looked to China, but was sort of moving away from that. And that's the context for much of his work. He wrote a book called Class Struggle in Socialist Poland in the aftermath of the sort of the crisis in Poland in the early 1980s, mm-hmm. in which he sort of pointed to the danger of counter-revolution and restoration at a time when many, many people on the left were supporting Solidarity and condemning the government in Poland. And then in 1983, he comes out with Human Rights in the Soviet Union. Tragically, a couple of years after the publication of that, in 1985, he committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. So definitely a very active active individual.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in terms of like in this movement, and obviously it was not easy for him.
No,
you know,
he took very controversial positions, and he took positions that were very, they were very unpopular in the mm-hmm. the milieu that he was trying to appeal to.
Well, yeah. So even in in the case of communists and like in the United States, like he's taking quite a courageous kind of step here.
I would say so.
You know, where he's addressing these kind of things. I didn't even know about him, and I can tell. I think you introduced him to me.
I think he should be a lot more well known than he is.
Yeah, I mean, certainly seems to be, like, you know, based on what I've read, it's very, very impressive. But really, going forward from this, what I really want to get to now is we talk about workers' rights mm-hmm. in the Soviet Union, right? And obviously, this is a very crucial aspect to look at,
yeah.
because of course the Soviet Union, you know, claims to be a workers' state, place where the proletariat is in control.
Yeah,
you know, where workers' power really is the, you know, they're the basis of the state itself, right? They're the ones who are in charge. It exists for their benefit. So, in terms of how did the rights of workers manifest in the Soviet Union?
Right, that's a very good question, mm-hmm. and very important question. So there are sort of three basic areas in the chapter on workers' rights in the Soviet Union that Szymanski talks about. And the first, I guess you could call sort of social services and the socialist welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
The second is the issue of the security of employment and sort of employment rights in themselves. And the third is the issue of workers' power and workers' control within the workplace and within the productive process. So, like I mentioned earlier, Szymanski provides a lot of very, very useful statistics, and I would encourage everyone to read Human Rights in the Soviet Union and to get these numbers for themselves. So I'm not going to talk too much in terms of the statistics. But the basic point that Szymanski makes about social provision and social services in the Soviet Union was that there was a wide area of social provision that was simply beyond what was available in any capitalist country. Even in the famous, the sort of proverbial European social democratic countries where social democrats were in power for decades.
So it's like Sweden and Norway,
exactly.
Places like
Sweden,
this.
Sweden, mm-hmm. Norway, these countries. That there's simply a level that's not compatible with capitalism that you can only really reach in a socialist society. And one of the most important aspects of that was housing, right? Housing in a capitalist society is a commodity. housing in the Soviet Union was available to every household as a matter of right. And, you know, if you did not have a house for your household, they would find one. Or, you know, new housing would be built if there were enough people in a city who couldn't find housing. There was no homelessness in the Soviet Union, categorically. It did not exist. And that I think is a staggering achievement. And it's, you know, it's difficult to even imagine, you know, living in a society like Canada where homelessness is prevalent. And
oh, yeah.
It's much worse than it was in the 1980s when Szymanski was comparing Western society and the Soviet Union. You know, homelessness today is much worse than it was even then in capitalist societies. So that was one thing. Everybody in the Soviet Union had housing as a matter of right. Healthcare in the Soviet Union was widely considered to be some of the best healthcare in the world. The Soviet Union had, of course, you know, a very extensive system of medical education and training. There were more doctors per patient than in any other country on Earth. So healthcare was of a very high quality, and it was also completely free at the point of delivery, and that was completely universal. And again, sort of earlier, you know, we were talking about the situation of nationalities in the Soviet Union. Even in the areas that had been the poorest areas of the Russian Empire before the revolution, healthcare was of the same quality as it was in Russia or in the Western, you know, European areas of the country. So there were no significant inequalities in the quality of healthcare, which was universal and universally very high. I mentioned education. Likewise, education in the Soviet Union was free at all levels, you know, up to and including university and graduate studies. And even after people finished their whatever education or training that they did, adult workers in the Soviet Union were encouraged to do adult education. And that was an easy thing to do. There were efforts made, you know, to really ensure, you know, lifelong learning, which is something that, you know, educational, yeah. You know, bureaucrats and policymakers and politicians in Western countries talk about all the time. But it's materially not an easy thing to do for working people in a capitalist society. You know, who has the time?
Well, yeah, and of course, what they mean is that you know, you need to constantly be between jobs. You have to be able to transition. You know,
absolutely.
Because there is no job security for you, obviously, in the capitalist economy. So you have to constantly, you know, be ready to make the change to a new job. That's what they mean by lifelong learning, which is, I'm assuming, is very, very different from what lifelong learning meant in a socialist society.
Yeah, whereas in the Soviet Union, there were real efforts made to ensure that everybody could continue with their education as much as they wanted to do for their entire lives. And I mentioned earlier the universal provision of childcare in the Soviet Union. So that's sort of a few areas where even compared to the strongest, you know, welfare states in the West, that the Soviet Union was just a level above. There's a qualitative difference because there are certain things that you can't, you know, take out of the area of the market in a capitalist society. And housing is one of them. It's always going to be a commodity, and that sort of imposes these limits that you can't actually reach in any capitalist society. In any capitalist society, no matter how you know, how progressive it looks. So that's, I think, the important point to make about the welfare state in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I think that needs to be mentioned in terms of, and this ties in, of course, with women's rights pretty intimately, is, of course, the issue of paid maternity leave, which, of course, was pretty universally available in the Soviet Union, you know, and is not universally available at all in Western capitalist societies. And, like, you know, that's definitely not the case in Canada. And, of course, you compare that to how far the Soviet Union actually came. This is actually an indicator of the Soviet Union's, you know, development. Like, this is an astonishing achievement, seeing that the Soviet Union, that, well, more like Tsarist Russia before 1917, women would actually give birth on the factory floor because they were never actually allowed to take any time off. Like, they were expected to keep working right up to the point of delivery. You know, and that was the norm. You know, so you had that, or people like being like kind of, you know, in labor, being hauled off the factory floor because they were in labor, this kind of thing. And that was normal. And you could see like how, you know, just decades after that, you know, it's the total opposite. Like, you know, paid maternity leave is just, that's normal. Everybody gets that.
Yeah.
You know, and just like what a difference that makes, and like how, you know, what a difference for working people, what a difference for women that makes.
Yeah.
You know, how empowering that is.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Just to go off of something that you just said, with the issue of job security and employment security. This probably, when I read this chapter, when I read Human Rights in the Soviet Union very recently, and when I read this chapter, that was probably what struck me the most strongly, was the degree of job security that existed in the Soviet Union. It was not impossible to be fired in the Soviet Union, but it was very, very difficult. You could not, with certain very limited exceptions, simply be declared redundant. That is, you could not be fired just because there wasn't, you know, enough work by
right.
management's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't just fire you because there wasn't enough work for you. If anybody in the Soviet Union if management wanted to lay off a worker in the Soviet Union, that worker could appeal. And if that appeal was denied, then there was a second level of appeal, which was to a board of people made up only of union representatives.
Yeah, this is in the trade unions, right? Which are
yes,
very
which
strong
which
in
all
the Soviet Union.
Yeah. All Soviet workers were members of. I'll get to talking about unions in the Soviet Union in a minute. So then you could appeal to this board of people who are all your union reps.
Yep.
And 50% of appeals that got to that stage were granted. So 50% of the time when somebody was laid off in the Soviet Union, they were able to actually keep their job in the end. And then if you lost that and you were ultimately laid off, your employer had to keep paying the wages that you've been making until you got a new job. They actually had to try and find you a new job in your field. If they couldn't find you a job in your field, they had to pay for the cost of retraining you to go do something else. So that's an important aspect of job security. There wasn't significant sort of unemployment insurance in the Soviet Union. In fact, it was the amounts would have been lower compared to a Western capitalist country, even compared to the United States. But that's because people didn't really need it. Of people who left a job or were fired in the Soviet Union at this time in the 70s, 60% of them would find a new job within the next 10 days. Almost everybody would find a new job within 2 weeks. So there was no such thing as long-term unemployment. There was no such thing as a situation that is the norm for so many millions of working people, even in the wealthiest capitalist countries, of weeks and months. And, you know, obviously for some people, years of unemployment and, you know, trying to find a place to stay and, you know, desperately looking mm-hmm. for work. That did not exist for any working people in the Soviet Union. There were periods of Soviet history when there were restrictions on people leaving jobs. Between 1940 and 1956, you had to get permission to leave your job. But that was because the Soviet Union was in a war economy and
yep.
then a war reconstruction economy. So that's entirely understandable. After that, it was perfectly, you know, fine to leave your job whenever you wanted. And people did that very frequently because this is kind of a side point, but even aside from the legal protections, the logic of the Soviet economy was such that there was a permanent shortage of labor. And that was a very, very good thing for workers. Unlike a capitalist economy where there's a permanent surplus of labor, there has to be, otherwise it doesn't really work. The Soviet economy had a permanent labor shortage. So people could decide to leave their job at any given time. And this is part of the reason why they would be guaranteed virtually to find a new one very, very quickly. So that's what there is to be said about job security in the Soviet Union.
And I think they even said, like Szymanski talks about how some people would actually emigrate from, say, the European provinces of of Russia and go to, say, like the less developed areas in Central Asia and places, because this is where the jobs were, because these are the areas where a lot of investment's going in. They're trying to empower and develop these areas of the country that have historically been oppressed.
Yeah, right? And this is the opposite of the pattern that you see in capitalist countries. I mean, you know, you see in Canada all huge numbers of workers from the Maritimes moving to Alberta. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this long-established pattern of people from the southern United States, or, well, it doesn't so much exist anymore, but for a long period in the history of U.S. society, you have people from the southern United States moving to the industrial Northeast and the Midwest, and you have these regions in the country, these pockets of underdevelopment and of mass unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Soviet Union, none of that existed. The Central Asian country, you know, the Central Asian regions of the Soviet Union had the same level of, you know, full employment. And there were, as you mentioned, incentives for workers from European, from the European Soviet Union to move to these other regions rather than the other way around, as it exists in capitalist countries, in between wealthy and poor capitalist countries.
Mm-hmm. So a very different situation.
Yeah. And then the third thing that Szymanski talks about is the issue of workers' participation in the productive process and workers' control over that process. And this is something that this is another sort of very, very misrepresented area. And this is something that even many, many people on the left, or even, you know, the left in Western countries, I suppose, misunderstand very, very badly. And there's a general, you know, there's a general trope among many people on the left that, you know, socialism is workers' control of production, and that didn't exist in the Soviet Union. You know, we can talk about different, you know, at the theoretical level, about different understandings of what socialism is and how that relates to, you know, workers' control in the workplace itself. But the simple fact is, even aside from the issue at that level, even aside from those questions, workers in the Soviet Union did have a great deal of power within the workplace. And Szymanski sort of discusses in a great deal of detail the institutional mechanisms that manifested itself in. So the starting point for that is the plan. Right. So, of course, we know the Soviet Union had a planned economy, you know, based on democratically determined, politically determined priorities for what people wanted to see happen in society. And then, you know, the scientists and the technicians had to try and figure out what they had the resources to do. And then it was sort of filtered back and forth between various administrative levels and, you know, enterprise management and these different areas. And eventually you have, you know, certain kinds of targets being sent to all the individual enterprises and workplaces in the country for what they were supposed to do in the next 5-year period. And then after that point, the workers in an individual workplace had a very, very wide area of latitude in deciding how they were going to go about meeting that. And they had power over the rhythm of work and pace. And they had power over, you know, assignments and tasks within the enterprise, over grading and, you know, categories of jobs, over bonuses to a large extent. Not so much over wages, because wages in the USSR were set centrally, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of, you know, bonuses and extra compensation. And that was sort of exercised through a number of different institutions. Szymanski talks about three. The first were the trade unions. And virtually every worker in the Soviet Union was a member of a union, although it was voluntary. You did not have to join the union, but almost, you know, the overwhelming majority of Soviet workers did. And unions in the Soviet Union had two roles. One was to represent the interests of workers, like unions in a capitalist society, and the other was to try and make sure that that workers fulfilled the plan, and you know, and that sort of production was developed and increased in line with the needs of society. But unions in the Soviet Union had an enormous amount of power in the workplace. Most of the areas that I just talked about were included in the collective agreement. Collective agreements were signed in Soviet workplaces every year. They came up for you know, renewal and renegotiation every single year. And ultimately, the union was the one that held the veto over that collective agreement. Ultimately, management had to agree with what the union was asking for in that collective agreement after, you know, whatever kind of negotiations they went through. And there was very little antagonism between unions and management in the Soviet Union, of course, because management's priorities were not, you know, to get as much as they could out of the workers. Management's priorities were to fulfill a certain set of social priorities that actually benefited the workers in that enterprise as well as in the Soviet Union as a whole. So this wasn't really a conflictual relationship. But even to the extent that things had to be negotiated, ultimately the union always had the winning hand in that negotiation. And then the second way that workers – the second sort of organization through which workers in the Soviet Union exercised power in their workplaces was through the workplace branch of the party.
It's the Communist Party.
Yeah, of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And every workplace, or at least every workplace of a significant size in the Soviet Union had a party branch, and typically something like a quarter of the members of the workforce of a given large enterprise would be in the party. And the party branch in the workplace was responsible for ensuring that the politically determined, democratically determined priorities of the plan were being met in the workplace. And they did a lot of work along the lines of trying to raise productivity and morale and try to mobilize people and sort of show people, you know, that they were working for these social objectives, I suppose. But they also had power over management.
Right.
The party branch also could basically dictate a wide variety of measures to management. And this is presented in anti-communist literature as, you know, the party leadership from the top controlling everything. But really what it was just one way in which workers at the bottom, so to speak, in the workplace exercised their power, because the party was not something, you know, separate from the workforce. The party was just a bunch of workers who decided to join the party, right?
They're still like in their enterprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
This is what people often
the same enterprise
often lose sight of.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the workplace branch of the party, and then there was a third sort of institution. I believe Szymanski calls them control commissions. Probably the phrase could be translated from Russian in different ways, and that was an elected body with representatives of the workforce. Representatives of management, representatives of the party, representatives of the Young Communist League, that existed sort of at the not at the individual enterprise level, but at the level of sort of a group of connected enterprises, or maybe a city, sort of a larger regional level.
Okay,
and they were responsible for exercising supervision over management of enterprises at that level and making sure that they were fulfilling their priorities. And there were also meetings that were held within enterprises where management had to sort of make an account of itself before the workers. And Western scholars, Western Sovietologists who went to the Soviet Union and sort of sat in on these meetings testified as to how stressful they were for management, and how this was in their accounts.
Yeah.
Even the accounts of Western scholars, clearly a very real manifestation of workers' control and of the ability of workers in a Soviet enterprise to have their voices heard. And not only that, not in the sense of, you know, some Western capitalist corporations have these kind of corporatist, measures where workers can have some kind of voice. But ultimately, in a Soviet workplace, it was the voice of the workers was louder than management. Ultimately, if there was a conflict between management and workers in a Soviet workplace, to the extent that that ever happened, it was the interest of the workers that won out.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible.
Absolutely.
All right. I think we're gonna take another music break with a very suitable song. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I guess Since I planted some long ocean seed of a song, went down inside me long ago. And now I can't remember when it was, but it joined up with the rest of them and grows. It's such a little song, it don't compare.